You are listening to the Animalia Hour, a radio show on KGVM and podcast dedicated to advancing a vegan lifestyle and animal ethics in this world and all possible worlds.
Hello, Kevin.
Hey, Sarah. How's it going?
I'm great. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it is.
Excited. And we're talking about checkoff programs today.
Yeah.
Such a ridiculous name.
It is a weird name. It's almost like one of America's dirty little secrets.
It's a dirty little secret. But seriously, the name, checkoff programs, like when I hear it, I'm always like, come on. There's no way, it's not possible that that is the official name of anything.
Right.
Checkoff programs.
Right.
We're not talking about Anton Chekhov,
right.
the novelist.
Right.
It's literally one word now, and it's spelled C-H-E-C-K-O-F-F.
Right.
Check. And we'll be talking about where this program got its name.
Got its name. Excellent.
I just want to, at the outset, I wanted to say that I'm getting a lot of my information today from the author David Robinson Simon. So feel free to check out his writing. He is a lawyer and an advocate for sustainable consumption. He works as general counsel for a healthcare company. He also serves on the board of the APRL Fund, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting animals. Mm. So let's get into checkoff programs. Here we go.
Yeah.
He begins his writing referencing Aldous Huxley.
Wow.
His 1932 novel, Brave New World.
Right.
In this novel, Aldous Huxley imagined a future in which humans exist solely to support the economy and are conditioned from birth to buy things.
Wow.
Eerily familiar. Government bureaucrats manipulate the sheep-like citizens with drugs and slogans to make them consume as much as possible. In Huxley's vision, and this is so he predicted this would be happening in the 26th century. 26th century consumers learn that, quote, ending is better than mending, and quote, this the more stitches, the less riches. That is, buying new things is better than fixing old ones. But for U.S. consumers, this eerie futuristic fantasy with government using marketing slogans and other undue influence to drive consumption has arrived a few centuries early.
Wow, that's crazy.
So, checkoff programs, as you're if you're tracking along here, definitely has something to do with the government getting involved in strongly encouraging the citizens to become bigger and bigger consumers.
Right.
Buying more and more.
Well, that's what they say about our economy, though, right? Our economy is a consumer-driven economy.
So checkoff programs, unseen and unknown, but felt everywhere. Mm. That's so interesting. When something can be so ubiquitous, it's affecting every single person's lives, from every single person's life, from literally birth. I mean, when we delivered our babies in hospitals, they were already pushing all this Disney merchandise.
Right.
We're training our people to become consumers as early as possible.
Right.
So our government uses innocuous sounding checkoff programs to encourage us to buy more animal foods and other goods. By the way, this author, David Robinson Simon, he's going to be using the phrase animal foods. Hmm. And when he says that phrase, he's referring to animal protein. Mm. To me, it's a little confusing. I would rather he just call it animal products or animal protein. But we're going to be using the phrase animal foods to describe basically meat, dairy, eggs.
Okay.
The government uses these checkoff programs to encourage us to buy more animal foods and other goods. The mechanism's name persists. This is how it got its name, okay? The name persists from a time when the assessments were voluntary. So there was a time when food producers could opt in or opt out. Mm. It was an optional assessment they could pay. And they could opt out simply by checking a box. Mm. So that's where we get the name. Nowadays, the programs are tax-like and mandatory for producers, even though the benign name remains. So does that make sense? There was a time when food producers could either opt in or opt out of these programs.
Right.
And all they had to do is check a box.
Right.
And that's how it got its name, the checkoff program. And it's
pretty simple.
They've kept the name, which, again, to me, I'm like, what a strange name. All right. So what is it? Basically, Congress slaps a small assessment, usually less than 1% of the wholesale price, on certain commodities. And this money that the producers are paying, the food producers are paying this 1% of their wholesale price, the money is collected and it's used to pay for research and marketing. So all this money is pooled, let's say, by all the beef producers, all the egg producers, all the dairy producers, all the poultry producers. So that all the producers pool this money and it all goes towards marketing and research. So it's a giant war chest of advertising and PR campaign money. So obviously the point of it is to boost the good sales.
Right.
To sell more.
Or you could just go out to the USDA site. The organization, the arm of the USDA that manages the checkoff program is called the AMS. And just to give you an example of what a fee would be, say, so we're talking about eggs, for example. The program is funded by a mandatory assessment of 10 cents per 30 dozen case of eggs sold. So that just gives you some idea of what each farmer or each producer is paying into this program.
Right.
For eggs.
And there's not a lot of protests about this assessment, this mandatory tax, if you will, because consumers have no idea it exists.
Right.
And also the producers feel that the money is actually being put to good use. It really is helping boost the sales. So we end up with these amazingly talented people putting together jingles and ad campaigns. Beef.
That's what's for dinner.
Milk. It does a body good. Pork, the other white meat. Those are definitely things I remember.
The incredible edible egg.
Yes, so that's the next one he mentions. He said that song it still echoes in people's minds. I mean, I remember the Got Milk campaign. I mean, you have all these sexy celebrities, huge posters of these sexy celebrities posing with this white mustache, Got Milk. And I mean, those posters were everywhere.
Right. Especially schools.
Especially schools. Right. Exactly. So written, spoken, or sung and flashed across every medium, including print, radio, TV, and the internet, these statements have bombarded American consumers for decades. Across the board, animal food checkoff programs are remarkably effective at making us buy more than we would otherwise.
Right. I'm sure, I don't know if you're going to get into it, but I'm sure there's quotas, like every year they probably want to increase it a little bit. They want to continue to grow the market.
Right. But thinking about that, I don't know. I mean, I think all of us feel like we're intelligent consumers, but advertising is very powerful.
Oh, it is.
And when the majority of the food that is advertised, and again, this is coming down from the government, it's a mandatory thing that this is happening, is dairy, meat, eggs.
Cheese, right, the whole thing.
You know, it's very powerful, and it's definitely causing us to consume more than we would without that advertising.
Maybe this goes into it, but like the supersizing everything, right?
Right.
Or like the pizza that has a stuffed crust with cheese in it.
Right. More cheese.
Yeah.
More, double cheese, triple cheese.
Right. Bacon double cheeseburger, like those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Right. It's just more consumption.
Yeah. In fact, you know, I've heard people say, isn't it interesting? The only foods you see advertised are really unhealthy foods. Why is that? Like, when's the last time you saw a cucumber be advertised or asparagus or sweet potatoes or beans or rice be advertised? The things that we really should be eating are never advertised.
Right.
So, I mean, it's almost to the point where, if I see a commercial for food, my brain's interpretation of that should be, oh, another food I should definitely stay away from.
Right.
If it's being advertised. And then
interesting.
The same person that I heard pointing that out was saying, okay, so yeah, it's egg advertisement, and then it's bacon advertisement, and then it's Kentucky Fried Chicken advertisement, and then, oh, painkiller.
Right. Heart medicine.
Yeah. Osteoporosis prescription.
Or pre-diabetic, pre-diabetes. Right, exactly.
So, like, and of course, there's a few beer commercials stuck in there as well, right. Always. But
and truck commercials, right?
Yeah.
It's like we're, yeah.
Yeah. So, they're remarkably effective. According to the USDA, for each dollar of checkoff funds spent promoting animal foods, the return on investment can range as high as $18. So, for each dollar put into the checkoff fund, the return on investment is $18.
Wow.
That's quite a good return.
That's an amazing investment. Holy cow.
So if you look specifically at the beef checkoff program, it raises sales by $5 per checkoff dollar.
Wow.
The pork checkoff program drives $14 per checkoff dollar spent. The lamb checkoff program provides an unusually huge boost. It drives sales $38
wow.
for every dollar spent, or 7 extra pounds of lamb for each dollar spent on promotion. But the biggest winner might be dairy. It recently boasted that over a year and a half, checkoff efforts contribute to more than 7 billion additional pounds of milk sold. That's an extra 47 servings of dairy per person in the United States, above and beyond the hundreds of servings we would have consumed anyways. I mean, of course, if you think about it, most producers have to come up with their own marketing money
right.
out of their profits. You know, so the fact that the government is so involved to demand this tax from producers, to pool that all of this money that benefits all of them so much
right.
is really an interesting thing.
Well, I also wonder if it benefits the larger companies versus the small time farmer. It's based on how much you produce, so maybe it all evens out.
But certainly something that says the incredible edible egg or beef, it's what's for dinner. It's just driving consumption from wherever the consumer can find that product.
Right.
So in the end, I'm hoping it would get, you know, spread out to the small farmer.
Right.
But now, there have been producers who have said, we don't want to participate. We don't want to have to pay this assessment.
Right.
There was a lawsuit in 2005. It was called Johans versus the Livestock Marketing Association. Johans was a beef industry participant who disagreed with the message of the latest beef campaign, and they claimed being forced to fund it violated their right to free speech.
Mm.
Well, the Supreme Court came back and disagreed with Johans, and they said this message is government speech.
Wow.
So it's a form of speech the government can make others support.
Wow, interesting.
This is America.
Yeah. Wow.
But the government can force you to make speech, according to the USDA and the Supreme Court. So checkoff programs run by the USDA are the mouthpieces of the federal government. So when you hear like any one of them, whether it be the National Pork Board or any of these producers speaking, you know that you're also hearing the message of the U.S. government.
Interesting. It's funny, you know, you and I both have kind of studied media criticism a little bit, and I think we always find it entertaining. But it just makes me think, just from elections to this, you know, advertising to whatever, so many Americans, so many people think they're independent thinkers. And
I mean, you have a good point. You have a good point about media criticism. That's the whole reason to study things like media criticism, because if you don't intentionally look at it critically, it is very powerful. It has power. And when you're exposed to advertising, if you don't look at it critically, it will influence you.
Yeah.
You know, and Congress has basically admitted through this that if these programs were optional, if producers did not have to participate,
mm-hmm.
it says ultimately a lack of government involvement would likely lead to the decline or maybe even the end of checkoffs.
Wow.
So for whatever reason, they're hugely invested.
Well, that just raises a whole nother question about animal agriculture and how much it's growing and how the projections and the forecasts are talking about it increasing, or at least that's what people want to do with it, farmers and ranchers and this kind of thing. But you have to wonder if what you just said is true, then how much are checkoff programs driving animal agriculture?
Yeah, right. He goes on to write, checkoffs, as we've already said, cause us to buy more animal foods than we would otherwise. Yet, judging from the data, Americans already eat plenty of these foods and don't need more. Teenagers, for example, consume 78% more saturated fat and 48% more cholesterol, both linked primarily or exclusively to animal foods, than government guidelines recommend.
Right.
So that's what's so crazy. The government has these guidelines that recommend how much of everything you should be eating, but then they push more and more and more and more advertising. Right. We're already consuming more than the guidelines say we should be, but they just keep pushing more and more advertising.
Right.
One in three U.S. teenagers is obese or overweight, triple the rate in 1963. Mm. And a growing number have diabetes or high blood pressure, diseases directly linked to meat and dairy consumption, and formerly seen only rarely before adulthood. I mean, this is where we start to get into, clearly, the motivation is not Americans' health.
Right.
The government is not trying to make us healthy. These corporations are not trying to make us healthy. They're trying to make money.
Right.
The huge milk promotion, Fuel Up to Play 60, for instance, enjoys more than $50 million yearly in government-mandated funding and reaches 36 million students in 70,000 schools. And checkoff funding helped the dairy board team with Domino's Pizza to offer pizzas in 2,000 U.S. schools.
Wow.
And of course, it's not just the kids who are overindulging in these foods. Adult Americans also routinely consume more animal foods than the USDA recommends.
Right.
So if you remember, checkoff money goes not just to marketing, but also
to research.
To research. Yeah. So let's talk about how these food producers spend this research money. Under federal law, checkoff funds are intended to be used for both promotion and research. Thus, the National Dairy Council, the largest of dairy's main checkoff-funded arm, the National Dairy Council, boasts that it, quote, partners with top universities and other research facilities across the United States to support nutrition research efforts. Dairy research funded by at least $58 million yearly is largely focused on finding ways to convince consumers that dairy is healthy. Since industry-funded research might be suspect, yes, it should be highly suspect, dairy takes steps to ensure its research appears unbiased. For scientific credibility, research must be published in a respected peer-reviewed journal. But here's the rub. The National Dairy Council ensures access to such journals and the benevolence of their editorial boards by donating cash to a number of nutritional organizations.
Mm, interesting.
These include the American Society for Nutrition, whose other corporate sponsors include Danon and McDonald's.
Wow.
And the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, brought to you by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Wow.
Both organizations publish prestigious research journals. Okay, so let's just back up a second. These organizations that sound so pure and so sincere, and that we should be able to trust them, the American Society for Nutrition and the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, they're both sponsored by Danon, McDonald's, or the Beef Association.
Right.
That's where they're getting their money.
I know.
So of course, that's a huge conflict of interest.
Yep.
Of course, that's going to make it really difficult for them to be objective and truthful.
Absolutely. Yep. Wow.
So he brings us back to really what should be the fundamental question here. Is it appropriate that the government is urging citizens to buy things, especially things they really don't need?
Right.
Is that really the role of the government? Do we want the government urging us to buy things, especially things that are not good for us or that we don't need? As the enabling legislation explains, checkoffs are meant to increase the overall demand. So the federal government doesn't promote food to boost consumers' health. After all, many of the foods we're urged to buy are bad for us, particularly at the levels at which we're told to consume them. So why do our elected and our appointed representatives tell us to eat more? Because industry demands it as a way to increase sales. And as we'll see, industry usually gets what it wants.
Yep.
So again, these checkoff programs, they encourage Americans to consume meat, eggs, and dairy at much higher levels than normal. They drive disproportionately high external costs, and checkoffs help to sicken an already ill nation.
Mm-hmm.
This might be just as good a place as any, since we're talking about, is it appropriate for governments to be doing this, is to remember, as much as we love our country, and we do, we are a sick country.
Right.
And it just reminds me, we just watched the Blue Zones episodic series on Netflix, where Dan Buettner researched and studied all the regions in the world where people are the healthiest and live the longest. And this is such an important lesson for the American consumer. All of these regions, he called them the Blue Zones, the diet is primarily, if not completely, plant-based.
Right.
There's very little animal protein in these diets. And his sixth blue zone was Singapore, where the government there is doing the exact opposite of our government. The government there is actually subsidizing and incentivizing foods that are healthy for people.
Right, and the foods that have, like, that are less healthy, that have sugar or whatever, processed food or
fat,
are more expensive.
Yeah.
And
so you're financially incentivized to choose the plant-based whole foods option.
Right. That's a great idea.
It is. I mean, if the government's going to be involved at all in influencing our consumer.
Right, that's what they should be doing.
Then they should be they should be encouraging us to use the healthiest option. So here are some takeaways. Although Americans already consume much more animal foods than the USDA recommends, that agency continues to oversee checkoff programs that spend $557 million yearly urging us to buy and eat even more of these foods. You know, I didn't watch the Super Bowl this year, but I can almost guarantee there were several $7 million ads taken out.
Right.
That were encouraging people to eat more chicken, more pork, more beef, more cheese. Checkoffs are remarkably effective. By funding aggressive marketing and research programs that convince consumers that animal foods are a healthy and necessary part of our daily diet, checkoffs boost sales by as much as $38 for each checkoff dollar spent. That word necessary, people really do believe that it's necessary to eat animal products to be healthy.
Yeah.
This is why when people find out that you're a vegan, they sincerely look at you in the face and say, what do you eat?
Right.
Like, I can't fathom that you could be alive.
Well, what was funny to me, and I talk about propaganda, I had a friend, he continues to tell me that the next health crisis is going to be vegans, unhealthy vegans. Like, we're going to flood the hospitals and we're going to cost the taxpayers so much money.
Because we're so malnourished.
Yeah, we're so malnourished. Yeah, that we're going to create a health crisis.
They're going to need to build a new hospital wing just for the malnourished vegans.
I know. I think it's so funny. I'm like, where did you hear this? It's crazy.
Without government involvement, checkoffs would be dramatically less effective and perhaps even non-existent. If the government wasn't forcing this, this advertising wouldn't be happening. If the USDA disengaged from checkoffs that promote animal foods, it would significantly reduce the nation's routine overconsumption of these foods.
Interesting.
So there's culpability on our government's part.
Oh, yeah.
Is what we're saying.
100%.
Like, they need to take responsibility for how they're making people sick.
Right.
So David Robinson Simon ends this section by saying this is what needs to change in our government. The USDA should also completely exit the business of promoting animal foods and leave that to the trade organizations. There is simply no reason for the US government to encourage the heaviest people on earth to eat more fat-rich food. Checkoff programs for animal foods should be discontinued so costs are no longer routinely passed on to consumers for messages that many consider insidious and inappropriate. Some people argue that food is a necessity, and this warrants the government reminders to eat. We need the government to remind us to eat.
Right.
Well, you know, clothing is a necessity. Lots of things are a necessity, but the government's not getting involved trying to sell more of those things. Finally, both the USDA's food stamp program and the agency's authority to make nutrition recommendations should be turned over to the Department of Health and Human Services. For decades, animal food producers have sought, usually with great success, to influence these programs in order to sell more goods. Removing the functions of nutrition assistance and guidance from the agency, the USDA, tasked with helping meat and dairy farmers sell more product, would end the worst conflicts of interest that plague the USDA.
Interesting. Yeah, and so that leads to recently, there's an organization out there called the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, and they just brought a lawsuit against the USDA on January 16th of this year, 2024. And they're basically charging, let me just read this. This is from the Physicians Committee's website. Ahead of the next Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee meeting on January 19th, the nonprofit Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine filed a complaint on January 16th with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, arguing that the dietary guidelines process is rife with conflicts of interest and routinely violates federal law by favoring interests of USDA checkoff programs that promote agricultural subsidies, including unhealthful meat, eggs, and dairy products. The complaint asked the USDA Office of Inspector General to intervene and ensure that the dietary guidelines process is not influenced by checkoff programs. And someone quotes, because their sole goal is to increase economic demand with no regard to human health. USDA's checkoff programs minimize and disregard any negative reported health effects of their commodities in promotions, advertising, and research, says the complaint. Wow. And it goes on. We can continue to dissect it, but that's interesting. Yeah, that's someone's trying to hold them in check.
The fact that it's always so interesting to me when people bring lawsuits against a government agency.
Right.
And it's like, remember the law? You're breaking the law.
Right.
Like it's against the law to have these conflicts of interest when we're recommending dietary guidelines.
Right. Here's another quote from it. It says, the USDA can't be trusted to develop the dietary guidelines for Americans as long as the agency's checkoff programs for meat, dairy, and eggs are influencing the guidelines to recommend the very foods that are making Americans sick. That's crazy. And that's from Mark Kennedy Esquire, Senior Vice President of the Legal Affairs for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Checkoff interference in the dietary guidelines is against the law and must end immediately. That's amazing that someone is trying to hold them accountable.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, this is how you have to do it, through legal action.
I also think it's interesting, like why does the USDA have to revamp and republish dietary guidelines every 5 years?
Right.
Like by now we know what we should be eating, right? Like,
right.
Like if they listen to the experts, it's legumes and vegetables and grains and fruits, right? Like why every 5 years do we have to go, what should people be eating?
Right.
So yeah, these new guidelines are supposed to be the 2025 through 2030 dietary guidelines that they're working on right now.
Right.
So we'll see.
Are they trying to keep up with evolution? Is this why they change every 5 years?
I don't know.
It's very interesting. That's an interesting question. Do you know what I mean?
Like, it should be. I mean, I can see why maybe we want to review it once in a while.
Oh, yeah.
Like, let's come back to it, make sure we're in line with this still. But
right.
I don't know. To me, like, rewriting it every 5 years, if they really do rewrite it, it seems like it's been about the same my whole life.
Right.
Which is, if you want strong bones and strong muscles, you know, make sure you get lots of animal protein.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's like a little primer, a little introduction for us, as well as probably some of our listeners. You know, we've been hearing about checkoff programs here and there in our research, but we decided to kind of take a little bit of a dive into it. And I definitely feel a little bit more confident that I know what the checkoff programs are and why they have that silly name to begin with.
Right.
They are definitely not something you can opt out of with a check of a box. It's something that producers are required by our government to participate in. And let's all really think about being a little bit more critical of what is being advertised to us when we watch TV or whatever we're doing, because it may not be in your best interest.
Right. 100%. Much of the material that we've been using to discuss checkoff programs comes from a book called Meatonomics: How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much and How to Eat Better, Live Longer, and Spend Smarter, by David Robinson Simon.
And we're also using his book to talk about our next little subject, which is also very important to discuss, which is subsidies. So let's get into subsidies.
Yeah, let's hear about this.
He starts his chapter on subsidies with a very powerful illustration. In 1991, you could walk into any McDonald's in the United States, hand the teenager behind the counter a single dollar bill, and take home a double cheeseburger or a chicken sandwich. Back then, a gallon of gas cost an average of $1.14 in the United States. Today, when he writes this book, it's $3.83. And the federal hourly minimum wage was $4.25. In fact, the purchasing power of a dollar was 70% higher 2 decades ago. But here's a surprise. Walk into a McDonald's today and hand one thin dollar to the teenage descendant of your former cashier. Unless you no longer eat such things, you can still leave with a double cheeseburger or a chicken sandwich. In fact, animal food prices, and I remember when he uses that phrase, he's talking about just animal protein. So the animal protein prices in the United States have been remarkably resistant to the forces of inflation over the past century, falling across the board in inflation-adjusted terms, while most other consumer goods continue to rise in price. Of course, for the consumer, the common knee-jerk reaction to lower prices is great. I can buy more.
Right.
But sadly, when things seem to be too good to be true, they really are. And
right.
He shows in this book that low prices are both cause and effect of a microeconomic system out of whack. In fact, by keeping the system in a perpetual state of disequilibrium or market failure, the forces of meatonomics create problems that affect almost everyone.
Hmm. And he wrote this book in 2013. So at this point, it's 10 years old, this information, this data at this point. But still, I would think that
the principles are going to hold
up. The principles, and it's proportional to today as well.
Right. He goes on, meat and dairy are cheap. From 1980 to 2008, the inflation-adjusted prices of ground beef and cheddar cheese fell by 53 and 27% respectively. That's amazing to me.
I know.
From 1980 to 2008, almost 30 years, the inflation-adjusted prices for ground beef fell by 53%, and the prices of cheddar cheese fell by 27%. During roughly the same period, the inflation-adjusted prices of fruits and vegetables rose by 46 and 41% respectively. The result is that in contrast to their relative prices 3 decades ago, today a dollar buys 3 times the ground beef compared to vegetables that it once did.
Yeah, that is unbelievable.
Wow.
And just so we're clear, we're not really talking, we're going to get into it, but we're not talking about the market value of these.
Exactly.
Of meat and dairy.
The cost of production.
Yeah.
All of those things.
We're not, because they're subsidized.
Exactly.
And that's kind of what we're going to get into.
So, yeah, let's give a definition of subsidies. The checkoff programs, that was probably something that a lot of our listeners have never heard of, right?
That's
kind of a industry secret that there's this treasury of advertising money that's just constantly being refunded.
Right.
To get us to eat more animal protein. But subsidies is a word I'm sure we've at least heard.
Yeah.
Subsidies is a sum of money granted by the government to assist an industry or business so that the price of a commodity or service may remain low or competitive. So basically, in a nutshell, if I could put it in my own words, the government grants money to the industry to allow the consumer cost to stay very, very low. So the consumer, when they go to buy that product, that commodity, is not paying the real cost at all.
Right.
But somebody has to pay it.
Right.
The subsidy just kind of confuses us and externalizes the cost. It spreads it over all of the taxpayers,
mm-hmm.
right? Because any money the government gives anybody comes from the taxpayer.
Right.
So taxpayers are basically paying for the real cost.
Right. And that sucks, right? Because if you're a vegan or vegetarian, you're still paying for meat consumption.
Exactly. He points that out here on one of his pages. He says, if your diet tends toward the omnivorous, you might feel a sense of satisfaction that the prices you pay for meat and dairy are lower than they would be if external costs were imposed at the cash register. On the other hand, if you don't eat animal protein, you might feel relief that at least you're not participating in the system. But in either case, your wallet or pocketbook is going to feel the hit. That's because, like it or not, even though we don't pay them at the cash register, we all do incur the cost of animal food production in one way or another.
Yeah, that's so sad.
Yeah, it's very frustrating.
But it's like what our country does, right? We go to war, and whether you favor war or not, you're paying for war. And whether you want to live a peaceful, nonviolent life and not eat animals and not eat animal products, you're still paying for it.
Yeah.
I wish we could opt out of this crap.
Right. Have a say in what we want to pay for.
Right.
If our values could dictate more of where our taxes go.
Right. Because we can do that with our investments or our 401k. We can choose to invest in green funds, these kinds of things, environmentally friendly investments. But when it comes to taxes or subsidies, we really don't have a say.
Right. So he's talking about how the real costs, the real expenses of producing animal protein, some of the big categories are defrayed into taxpayer subsidies, but also healthcare costs we all end up paying for the people who consume a lot of animal protein, and of course the environmental costs that we're all going to end up paying for.
Absolutely.
I think it's really interesting to point out that it was after the Great Depression that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, actually started farm subsidies in his New Deal program. Of course, back in that day, there were no enormous factory farms or CAFOs, which we're going to come back to. So at that time, the farm subsidies all went to the little guy, the farmers who were just trying to eke out a living.
Right.
So the book says, when the Depression hit in 1929, prices of farm goods fell like corn stalks in a gale. President Franklin Roosevelt responded with New Deal programs, including subsidies, designed to stabilize prices and boost small farmers' incomes. The system worked at first, but as large farms came to dominate the agricultural landscape, less and less of the subsidy funds wound up in the little guy's pockets. Today, the handouts are aimed at big farming concerns. Taxpayers paid out $161 billion in direct payment farm subsidies between 1995 and 2009. But two-thirds of U.S. farmers didn't receive a cent. The funds mostly went to big corporate players, with one-fifth of the recipients grabbing nine-tenths of the cash.
Right. And so what I feel like when I read this chapter, you started to realize that government subsidies, I don't want to say created CAFOs or factory farms, but they sure as hell encouraged or highly incentivized factory farming.
Absolutely.
And CAFOs. And it's sad. It's like we've created this mess. And then we have the checkoff programs that cause most people to overconsume, overpurchase these products. It's like a vicious cycle.
Right.
And the small farmer is getting screwed.
Exactly. So much of the subsidies are skewed towards animal agriculture.
Right.
In fact, vegetables and fruits, the government calls them specialty crops, and they're ineligible to receive subsidies. The only crops, primarily at least, that receive any subsidy money are the feed crops.
Right.
The corn.
Soybeans.
The soybeans. Yeah. Simon writes, the expense of feeding hungry animals is a huge part of the cost of doing business in animal agriculture. This food accounts for almost half the cost of raising hogs and nearly two-thirds the cost of producing poultry and eggs. But crop subsidies come to the rescue by helping producers keep their feed costs low. One study found that crop subsidies and the resulting lower feed prices allowed factory farms to decrease their operating costs by as much as 15% from 1997 to 2005. Their operating costs actually decreased by a lot.
No, I know. It's because of they've increased efficiencies, which are more brutal to the animals, right?
Yeah.
And so they're saving money by being more brutal.
And they're paying less and less and less
exactly.
for the feed crops. So they saved, it says, factory farms saved nearly $35 billion over that period. As these programs favor big operators over small, they not only fail their original purpose of helping small farmers, but they also go a step farther, and they actually help drive small farmers from the rural landscape.
It's so much harder for the smaller guy to compete with these larger, efficient factory farms. It's unfortunate.
Right. And it's just so ironic that the government itself is sending such mixed messages,
right.
These incongruities. The federal government, on the one hand, recommends in the Dietary Guidelines for Americans that we consume less cholesterol, less saturated fat, but it heavily subsidizes the foods that are the main sources of cholesterol and fat, meat, fish, eggs, and dairy. Again, on the one hand, the dietary guidelines recommend that we eat more fruits and vegetables. So you would think the government would get behind it, encouraging the consumer right. to eat more fruits and vegetables. But the government designates these foods as specialty crops that are largely ineligible for subsidies. The net result, nearly two-thirds of government farming support goes to animal protein that the government suggests we limit our consumption of, while less than 2% of subsidies goes to the fruits and vegetables it recommends we eat more of. And he says, by the way, the USDA officially declined to comment on this or any other issues in this book.
Wow.
So it's just crazy that our government, again, these authorities that we hope have the best interests of the citizens at heart, are actually encouraging us to do the very thing that's making us sick.
Right. It's also what we've learned in other documentaries and other books, that big pharma and big ag are kind of in bed together, that the board of directors of one is on the board of directors of the other, these different various companies. I mean, they're all working together. I mean, if you think about it, kind of just what you said, it's like we have more heart disease, more type 2 diabetes, keep hearing about pre-diabetes. And yet it's exactly these animal products that are leading to these ailments. So it's like the food industry leads to the medical industry.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
Did you know that there's even a water subsidy for farmers? Oh, my goodness. He writes about...
I knew they got tax breaks.
Yeah. So there's a massive water subsidy program for farmers a few hours from where the author lives in Southern California. In California's Central Valley, irrigation subsidies let farmers use roughly one-fifth of the state's water, and they pay only a small fraction of its value. They pay about 2% of what LA residents pay for water.
No, I know, and that's exactly what pisses me off about when we keep hearing about climate change and drought. I mean, the amount of water that it takes to feed these animals and take care of these animals is unbelievable. And the fact that they're not paying the full cost of it, it's just crap. I mean, and we are paying for it.
Yeah. And especially when you would hope that subsidies would stay somewhat true to their original goal of helping the small farmer. But small farmers are among the biggest losers under the subsidy program. Subsidies distort the normal market forces of supply and demand, making small farmers overproduce even when it's inefficient to do so. For an example of math that doesn't really add up, consider when subsidies reduce the market price of corn to levels below what it costs to produce corn, U.S. farmers nevertheless continue to grow it in record amounts.
Right. And then what do? We dump it into third world countries is what we do, and we affect their markets.
Exactly. He writes, in addition to plowing over our own small farmers, U.S. farm subsidies routinely hurt the little guys throughout the rest of the world. Mm. Because Meatonomics heavily subsidized feed crops like corn and soybeans for decades, U.S. farmers have sold these crops on world markets at prices well below their cost of production. This is classic dumping, the selling of goods in a foreign market at less than fair value. When we dump, we burden our neighbors with genuine penalties in the form of severe economic and social disruption. In developing countries where 60% of the people still earn their living in farming and sometimes get by on incomes of a dollar per day, the results of dumping can be catastrophic. Small farmers would ordinarily be challenged to compete against a large agribusiness merely because of the economics of scale enjoyed by the larger competitor. But these small farmers have an even harder time competing when subsidies permit the large business to consistently sell at prices below its own cost of production.
Right.
This slanted playing field drives small farmers out of business and off their land, and it contributes to widespread socioeconomic problems in developing countries. Dumping by U.S. corporations has had devastating effects on a number of developing nations, including, by way of example, our neighbors to the south. The influx of cheap U.S. corn flattened Mexican corn prices by 70% from 1994 to 2003, contributing to a 20% drop in Mexico's minimum wage and helping boost the nation's unemployment rate to 50%.
What the heck?
In an ironic twist, when Mexicans seek employment in the same U.S. industry that helped put them out of work, those lacking documents are rounded up, in some cases prosecuted, and deported. It's not just a metaphor. We have literally beggared those around us. And for some, validated by the words of journalist Mignon McLaughlin, few of us could bear to have ourselves as neighbors.
Isn't that sad? I mean, it's horrible.
I know.
We dump our surplus into a third world country. We screw their economy. And then they just want to make a living. So they come to the United States undocumented, become quasi, quote unquote, illegal immigrants.
Yeah.
And then we criminalize them and then kick them out of here. It's like, what the f-?
And of course, it's not just our neighbors that are closest to us. United States policy contributes to reduced incomes, increased unemployment, loss of land, and a decline in quality of life in all third world economies. Subsidized agriculture in the developed world is one of the greatest obstacles to economic growth in the developing world. So this is, like, again, kind of what Kevin was saying earlier. We're vegan not just for the animals. Like, that is good enough reason right on its own. But of course, it also spills over to horribly affecting human beings around the world. when we support these industries that are just not good for anybody.
Right.
Honestly.
Whether you like it or not, we're all contributing to it.
Yeah.
It's just sad. It's like we don't have a choice in it. It's a systemic problem.
But I would say that there is still power in what we purchase as the consumer. And as, you know, we've seen evidence that more and more companies are starting to pay attention, that people are interested in vegan options and plant-based milks. They need, it does affect the market.
No, you're right. But I mean, that might be how we affect the market, is our personal choices, not how we vote. I mean, obviously, we can try to do both, but we may see results faster with our pocketbook.
So now, hopefully, we all feel a little bit more confident that we know about what the checkoff programs are and how they are manipulating us to over-purchase more animal protein than we would normally, which is just amazing to me. And then farm subsidies, that these huge CAFOs, these huge factory farms, are the ones who are benefiting so much economically from these farm subsidies that are driving small farmers out of business here and around the world.
Yeah. Again, this is just a taste of these two programs. We're going to probably return to subsidies in the future episodes, but this is just give you a little idea of how they work and how we are all affected by them.
Yeah.
Whether we're a farmer or not.
Yep. The more we know, hopefully the smarter we can be.
Yeah. All right. Well, peace in the Middle East.
Thanks, everybody, for listening, and have a great day.
Take care.